Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Midrats. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And for those that are joining us live, if you wanted to, go ahead and pop in with the chat room with the usual suspects as we go through today's topic. If you have some observations or questions you would like for us to engage our guests with, feel free to throw them in there, and we'll fold them in as the conversation goes along. And you can always catch up with the previous episodes either over Blog Talk Radio at the show page's archive, or you can have it automatically sent to you so you can listen on your MP3 player at your own leisure via the free podcast on iTunes. Now, let's get on with the show. For the last 6 months, our first topic of the day, we've had a conflict that's kind of in either the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end as Tripoli slowly gets secured one roadblock at a time. A conflict that has brought out a question that is constantly brought up over and over again because people forget in quiet times what really makes the difference when the shooting starts and you have to try to influence effects globally, and that is, where are our carriers? And I think our allies have been taught another important lesson. And to discuss this lesson in its variety of ways, it will be author, historian, and military strategist Dr. Norman Friedman, whose recent article in the August 2011 USNI Proceedings, I think, outlined in a page and a half with a big picture the discussion that we always seem to have in national security areas about the essential effectiveness and, even for you green eye shade people, the efficiency of carrier-based air and not just the big deck carriers, which everybody liked to have, but even down to the Italian-sized carriers and what the Brits used to have. Land-based air, that argument has been around for a very long time. It has its place, but there is the tyranny of distance that mutes that argument when it actually has to try to create effects ashore. And that's what we're going to work on till the bottom of the hour. Norman, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you for having me.
And like I said, when I picked up my August issue of Proceedings and I saw that, I said, right away, we've got to get Norman back on here. Because back when I was a little kid, just to make myself feel younger than I am, I remember the white paper that came out in around 1980, I believe, over in the UK, that talked about how we got this great tornado strike aircraft and that in our tankers. They had nice little maps that went with it, too. I'd love to get a copy of it. It talked about how they can cover all the world's oceans from the ground. And so the Brits got rid of their traditional carrier, and then the Falklands came along just at the right time to save the British carrier air. So they rediscovered the joy of the naval gun, and they also discovered the requirements of aircraft carriers and being able to have those available when you need it. But lo and behold, when Libya came around, what was the one ally that did not have carriers? That was the British. And Norman, this discussion that happens on a regular basis, the RAF and people with that argument, it keeps coming up, and in some cases wins. What is that central argument that the air power people make, and what is its critical defect that the reality of operations keeps reminding us about?
Well, they keep missing things. The people who talk about land-based air will always show you that a plane can fly remarkable distances, especially if it has tanker support. And they almost never seem to ask about what it does when it gets there. So that, yes, you can fly this incredible distance, but you don't stay around the target very long. Oh, well, but that's the target. Well, if you are doing air support in a changing situation, hanging around is what matters. The fact that you can fly some ludicrous distance isn't what counts. If you look at many of their claims, they're about input. If you're on the ground waiting for someone to bomb somebody trying to kill you, it's about output. Go back to the Falklands. There was a spectacular operation mounted by the RAF in which they flew a Vulcan over Port Stanley and dropped bombs, which actually missed the airfield. And whenever you read about it, the air power people talk about how wonderful it was, and I think they needed something like 18 tankers because they had to tank the tankers,
yep.
And they flew this incredible distance, and wow, wasn't that wonderful? And I'm sitting there, I'm not even a British taxpayer, but if I were, the question would be, and then what did you get out of it? And I think the answer is they missed the runway. The other thing is, if you have no nuclear weapons, if nuclear weapons are off the table, as they are in most cases, and properly so, dropping a bomb on a target is most unlikely to have a decisive effect. And that's the thing that people forget. The Libyan thing was supposed to be over very, very rapidly. That's why everyone got in. It wasn't. It wasn't. Say again?
Well, I was going to say that. This article that we're referring to is an opinion piece you wrote for the World Naval
right.
Development section of Proceedings called The High Cost, No Carriers. For those people who are not Proceedings subscribers, this thing is hidden behind a subscription wall. But to sum it up, I mean, you've taken the Libyan operations and from that extrapolated the fact that the Royal Navy got sold down the river somehow. They don't have any sufficient carriers at the present time, any carriers at the present time,
right.
And the RAF, although as you note on paper, looks like it can do the job. The reality is they really can't. And so, have I summed it up accurately?
Yes, sure. And the problem is that the job is not properly defined. The Air Force guys always talk about whether an airplane can reach some target. They never talk about what it does when it gets there. And the whole Libyan operation is a demonstration that air power is not as decisive in small bits as people want. And in fact, what ends up winning is probably a Libyan ground force of rebels backed up by Western Special Forces who trained them with air support. And it took a long time. And it may take longer because Gaddafi is still at large, and he may have friends, tribal friends, for example, who still like him. This thing can get nastier.
Yeah, I thought one thing that was interesting is we saw, and maybe you have found a place in the U.S. that did a good job, but just as kind of a side issue, I thought that the whole conflict was horribly and superficially covered by the American press. The British and the English language continental press, they did pretty good coverage, I thought, of a lot of the issues, especially the British press, because the Royal Navy did a little bit of a tut-tut and I told you so's in their press.
Right.
But we saw the first week in November, the first week in August, the Norwegians called it quits. The Danes
mm-hmm.
called it quits. The French with the Charles de Gaulle, yes, it's a CVN, but it's a much smaller CVN than what an American thinks of as a CVN. She had done all she could do. She had to go back. I was impressed by the French. They did the best they could, considering there were limited operational experience with their carrier. They got home. I mean, the Italians went up and did a little bit, and they went home. It looked like the ground campaign kind of saved what could have been a rolling train wreck coming in this fall as everybody went home. But you look at the lessons that people can take away from this operation, and as always, you're concerned that people will take away the wrong lessons versus the right lessons. And you touched
absolutely.
On kind of an untold story there was mostly British and French, but there were some NATO forces on the ground, but they were special forces trying to work with the with the rebels and the tribal forces to push the Gaddafi family out of Tripoli?
Well, the first lesson is, if you look at the war as a whole, people after Kosovo thought that a little bombing would win a war. And I think that that's probably why everyone involved in the NATO operation here had no idea how big an operation this was going to be. You want to talk about wrong lessons, that's a winner. And the problem in Kosovo was that you could end the Kosovo war on a negotiated basis. The Milosevic didn't really want Kosovo all that badly. What he wanted was power in Serbia. And he was able to portray himself as a victim of NATO and retain power where he cared. By way of contrast, if they ever catch Colonel Gaddafi, I doubt he'll get a trial. He knows it. So for him, it's win everything or lose everything. There's no reason for him to fold prematurely. And that alone means a much nastier slog. I don't think people recognize the difference at the start. Once you see that, now you start asking, well, what is the effect of the weapons? Because before you can talk intelligently about the weapons, you have to ask where it's supposed to be going. There were very serious problems of divided control and even divided war aims within NATO. The French press pointed out that if the French had had their preferences, they would have moved in Foreign Legion and just steamrolled it in about a week, with de Gaulle supporting their own troops. And the nature of the NATO agreements, they blamed the British, actually, but that may merely have been the usual way. The UN mandate, which was, to put it mildly, somewhat obscure, prevented any such quick ending. Now, it may be that from the Libyans' own point of view, and participated heavily in winning their freedom, that will mean a lot more to them, and it's better for them in the end. But if you're somebody Libyan who got killed in the process, this is not going to sound too good. So, yes? Hello?
Bob, I think we may have lost Eagle One in the process. I'm sorry.
No, you got me.
Oh, okay.
I thought you were going to go on for a minute. You make a good point. I mean, the divided command and all that, and I think one of the points of your article too is an excellent point, that part of the problem with the mission that was undertaken by NATO here is it required continuous air presence, and the way that the air power was structured for this is that's just not available anymore.
Right.
Without the carriers
well, no
being
one has, there. No one has these vast numbers of airplanes. Continuous, it's the difference between what Air Forces like to fantasize about, which is strategic bombing, where there's some key target, you wipe it out, and everything follows from that, and reality, which is supporting an ongoing operation, where you are acting essentially as the artillery for someone else. You have to be present all the time, otherwise the other fellow gets to shoot back. If you can't be present all the time, then you're not worth paying for. And that's a very serious problem.
I think that argument was, there was a couple of Royal Navy types that I read that were trying to bring the argument forward. They were talking about the transit time from the Italian air bases,
yes,
most of the British
absolutely
were making. Whereas, coming off the Charles de Gaulle, big Chuck out there,
right,
that your transit time is very short, so you're really able to respond to intel much, much better. And
right,
that's an argument that on paper people were talking about stories and distance and stuff. But to make the effects you want to make on the ground to get that sustained ability to react, that transit time, it's money.
Well, the problem is that the people who make the choices, particularly in Britain, I think, are typically analysts who create models of reality and no one ever checks to see if they're real. We've had that problem too. Remember Mr. McNamara?
Yep.
And I think that they bought into a lot of that stuff. I think what happened in England was that when they were faced with very serious financial trouble, they decided that somehow they would divvy up missions among the services, and they would eliminate what looked like duplication. So at the same time that they killed the carrier air, they also killed RAF fixed-wing ASW, because the Navy could do ASW, and clearly they do it really well, whereas the RAF could bomb things. And that's just somebody who doesn't understand that it's not a matter of being nice to the services. These are national capabilities that they were trying to figure out. Somebody did not make a very good argument in Whitehall.
I was kind of struck that as they planned this current mission, they didn't look back at the line of death Gulf of Sidra thing, where the U.S. had to fly, didn't have to, but I mean we had bombing missions coming out of England and had to tank them and avoid France and all that other stuff. I mean, the parallel to me seems to be pretty obvious. I perhaps it wasn't quite as obvious to them.
Well, there are a lot of cases of land-based air where people leave little things out. For example, you're flying an endless mission, you're F-16, to bomb somebody in, say, Afghanistan. And the only reason it's endless is that you have to fly from somebody who will let you use a base. But after all, if you don't do that, it won't prove that the Air Force is incredibly good. So you fly your endless mission. Surprise! Your airplane can fly a great distance if it gets tanked, but you may not be all that alert when you get there. Oh, you mean you're going to make mistakes? Pilots make mistakes? Yeah. And we've sort of avoided thinking about that. It's a general disease. If you look at the paper characteristics of the airplane, which is what they look at, you miss the reality. And the reality is, if you want a lot of missions, if you want to be very responsive, or you want to spend most of your time near the target, you better be close to the target. People kind of don't notice.
Yeah, I think a lot of that derives from, I call it, you know, people who understand a conflict PowerPoint thick, where they see it up on a slide with a circle and an arrow, and they think that's what actually operationally is going to reflect. Another thing I really liked that you brought up in your article, Norman, is, and you touched on it real briefly when you were talking about how somebody lost the argument in Whitehall, is in many respects, especially here, sometimes you get the feeling the argument isn't taking place because of a mentality that derives from Goldwater Nichols, whereas in a representative republic, we like to talk about how things work well because we have a vigorous debate and creative friction.
Absolutely.
But it almost seems that Goldwater Nichols has become this stultifying Stalinistic tool where everything has got to be joint to the point that you cannot have an open, and I think the argument needs to be open, not behind closed doors, an open argument about how you create effects globally inside of our national security strategy. It doesn't need to be purple. Sometimes the answer is green. Sometimes it's dark blue.
Well, you do remember that Goldwater was a Reserve Air Force Brigadier General. And there is a cultural difference between Air Forces and Armies, on the one hand, and Navies. Navies tend to be a lot more pragmatic. There's another thing also that I don't think I fully appreciated when I wrote the article, and that is that Air Forces had to fight very, very hard just to exist. And if you spend most of your time making your claims, there may be unfortunate consequences in your ability to carry out what you claim you can do. The problem the Royal Navy has had is that it hasn't appreciated that since not that much travels by sea anymore except things, not that many people travel by sea, governments tend to forget how important the sea is.
Yeah, I think you hit that in one of your concluding paragraphs in your piece about, I think you said the lesson the U.S. Navy has learned that the realities of sea power need to be that have to be explained again and again. Can you kind of
absolutely
extend,
that's what
extend those, and revise those comments?
Absolutely. That's what all those strategy things are about. That's because when the modern U.S. Navy was created, the United States was a land-oriented country. The Navy had to make its point. And it made its point very, very effectively. To the extent that we think of the United States now as a maritime country. But in 1890, when we first started buying battleships, most Americans did not think of this as maritime at all. They thought of this as a country where maritime things were sort of unimportant. The U.S. Navy got the message, and hopefully it continues to give the message, although Goldwater Nichols may hurt it very badly. The Royal Navy doesn't seem to have gotten the message the same way.
I would think that.
And that's hurt.
And, you know, one thing that we've talked about here before with some previous guests, and you also touch on in the article, is you know, as we go towards, I don't think we fully appreciate the budgetary pressures that we're going to see in the next few years. You combine that with the argument of what we do with what defense dollars we have, that in theory, if we were allowed to have an open debate, that would lend itself towards sea power being a relatively economically efficient and flexible tool of national security. Could you touch on that for a little bit, the economic advantages that could bring?
The point is, you have to start asking what you need for security. You want American strategy for a very long time has been we would prefer bad things to happen abroad rather than at home. That may seem so obvious, it's kind of ludicrous, except that many governments don't get that message. We have the benefit of being able to do that because there's a lot of space between us and people who don't like us in general. That would change if, say, Mexico or Canada became a major problem. But as long as they're not, we can act like the United States is, from a national security point of view, an island. So then the question is, how much fixed structure do you put abroad to do that? Well, anything that's fixed abroad costs you a lot. Bases cost, garrisons cost, political agreements to have bases cost a lot. The more you are at sea in international waters, the less that counts. And that's an argument for a mobile type of power. Now, the Air Force would have argued in the past that they provide exactly that with bombers flying out of the United States. And they have a current project for global instant strike. Somebody's bad to us, you fire this missile, and it gets to his head, and it kills him, and it's all over. And the appropriate answer to that is, it's baloney. Nothing works like that. Intelligence is never that good. So if you can't know something is about to happen in advance, either you put troops ashore with aircraft or you show up with ships. And it seems to me that the ships are far better economically. They require far less agreement. They're more mobile. The world changes unexpectedly. Seems to me that there's no problem, but I'm sure that these arguments will be swept away in a moment in Washington. Debate is not always terribly honest.
Well, it goes to the question of, as the Navy looks ahead, are they projecting a fairly substantial carrier force, 12 or 14 carriers, or do you see them reducing that down to some other level?
Well, I'm not privy to that. And if I were, I wouldn't be talking. Certainly, people in the Defense Department have acted as though we can cut. And I was very disturbed when Secretary Gates, who retired, said, well, why do you need so many carriers if no one else has a lot of carriers to fight you? And the answer is no, they don't have to do with fighting another Navy one-on-one. They have to do with projecting American power where it's needed, when it's needed, and not when it isn't. And if that message was not put across properly to him, we have real problems. And of course, There's also the issue of the Chinese with their supposed carrier-killing missile. And there've always been people who regard the carriers as sort of unnecessary and expensive. I don't know why they should think that, but you see it around.
One thing, you know, we were looking at carriers, and the French, obviously, they have, except for their E-2s, they pretty much have an all-French production flight deck, good for them. But when you look at all the other small carriers that our allies have, and we operate even, you know, we call our amphibious
right.
ships, but we really have light carriers as well that carry the Harriers. If the F-35B becomes some type of political budgetary football and dies, or there's some engineering issue that's yet to be addressed, do we really have a plan B if the F-35B doesn't come into being?
Oh, dear. Actually, no one has a plan B. My guess personally is that that will give way to some kind of unmanned vehicle. And then the question is whether one of those things will end up having some vertical takeoff capability. But it always amazed me that the people who made the Harrier didn't go around saying, you know, this thing might work out. We got this way out. Maybe you'll see Harrier production restart. I think you're not allowed to say that while F-35B is a possibility. But, yeah, I can believe it goes down the tubes. I can believe the whole JSF program goes down the tubes. It's a very expensive airplane. It was supposed to be a very cheap airplane, and it was asked to do a great deal with software. And it's very difficult for people to estimate what trying to do things with software costs, and they found that it's kind of expensive. I don't know what's going to happen with that.
Yeah, I've always been worried that we could go back to the mentality created by Goldwater Nichols. You know, building off the great success of the F-111 Bravo, that
you see dozens of those things all over the place, don't you? Yeah, right.
Usually on a stick somewhere, but you put so much into one basket that's ladled with technology risk, and you really can put the entire nation in a fair bit of at least operational, if not strategic, risk when all of a sudden it does not have a platform that is relatively modern that can execute a mission, which unfortunately we put so much in the 35.
Well, it's kind of scary. If you like airplanes, you watch the number of manufacturers go way down. You watch the number of different models that are around at any one time collapse. And then what happened in F-35 is particularly sad because it started out as a very austere airplane that you could build in large numbers at a reasonable price. And then the austerity was achieved by cutting back on platform characteristics, performance, stealth, things like that. And then someone said, well, but we can get some of this back with better software. So you have that amazing thing where the pilot can look down through the airplane and see below it. You know about that?
Yeah.
There's a knitted characteristic that's apparently quite elaborate. Well, all of that is horribly expensive. And there doesn't seem to have been any thought as to trading off those things. It was sort of allowed to grow without control. And now, surprise, surprise, it's kind of expensive. By the way, enough of the cost has been sunk already that it's kind of hard to cut it.
It is, and I think a lot of that was caught up in the love of the exquisite vice, that which you can actually take off and land with. And Norman, in the minute that we have left, if you had an opportunity to sit down with, let's forget the Americans for a second, but you had the Italians, the Spanish, the French, and the Royal Navy, four stars in front of them, if you give them your top three lessons coming off of Libya, what would they be?
Buy a carrier with cats and traps. Two of them if you can. The future of the world is going to be further away from your country than you can go with land-based air. land-based air was really good if you thought that the future was a kind of world war in Europe. If the future is misery in the third world, you got to be able to get there. If you want to get there, you're going to have to swim there. And then you're going to have serious air support. Putting twos and threes of cruise missiles on your frigates isn't going to hack it. The only way you can do sustained air far from home is a flat deck. And given what's probably going to happen to the F-35B, don't be suckered into going down a street where there are no alternatives. If the British had bought cats and traps, they could have gone to any number of other airplanes, like F-18s or Rafales or something like that. This way, they decide to buy themselves a very large carrier, the one that's being built now, without that capability. That's insane. That was just a couple $100 million. You want to save peanuts, you'll end up badly.
Penny wise and pound foolish.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. Norman, that's a very quick half hour, and it's been a joy to having you back on MidRats, and I really appreciate taking the time to come back.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir.
And we'll see if we can pick some other natural disasters to make us think about calling you on next time. We'll just have it on the other side of the country.
Thanks.
Yes, sir. And I want to thank I want to thank everybody who's been joining us so far. Just as a reminder to everybody, you are listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio MidRats. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with Eagle One from Eagle Speak. And we're going to shift slightly in time and place, but the topics, I think, overlap a lot. Our next guest is going to be somebody that a lot of y'all are familiar with, and for a good reason, because when you look back at the waning days of World War II, a lot of people go, oh, yeah, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, flash, bang, we win and go home. But that's not how the people in 45 saw it. There was a very brutal, because it needed to be brutal, a very heavy plan on how we were going to end the war with Japan. And it wasn't going to take a couple of months. It was going to take years. And our guest is here going to talk about that. He is going to be Dennis Giangreco. His books are under DM Giangreco. He's been, for the last two decades, he's been an editor of Military Review at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. But he's also an award-winning author of over 12 books on military and socio-political subjects, and he's written extensively for various national and international publications and new agencies. And for his latest book he put out, he is the author of the Gutzeit Award for Best Military History Book in 2009 that was awarded by the New York Military Affairs Symposium for his book, Hell to Pay, Operation Downfall and the Invasion of Japan, 1945 to 1947. And as we're, depending on which country you're in, we're in the General VJ Day era, and it's a good time to come on and talk to him about another weapon system and the change that's had in our history. Dennis, welcome to MidRats.
Well, hey, how you doing out there?
We're doing great, and really appreciate you taking time this Sunday to come on for our National Disaster Era MidRats. I think everybody has knocked over a lawn chair or two, but everybody has come through pretty well. And what was fascinating about your book is we've all known that, there's this big plan to go in Japan, but for us Gen X types, when we were growing up and starting to get interested in the news, it seemed that in the era of the three news networks and PBS, that once a year everybody was forced to put on their hair shirts and beat themselves with rods and thorny branches with the bombing of Hiroshima. It was almost an annual pilgrimage. Mayors and governors would go out to Japan and apologize and various things of that manner. And there wasn't much discussion that really fleshed out that era. But recently, we've been blessed with a couple of things. There's been some superior scholarship on the subject, your book, but also there's a more variety of news forces, news sources for people to tap into, to give us a well-rounded view of what those two nuclear weapons actually enabled us to come into the modern era a lot different than we would otherwise. You know, real fast, what when you wrote Hell to Pay, what was one of the first big takeaways that, that really hit you hard as you started to do your research?
Well, really, the scale of the enterprise. In that same period that you were talking about when you were growing up, you know, people would kind of scoff at Stimson's, you know, comment that the entire operation, you know, if the entire operation was going to be involving at all levels a total of about 5 million men, and you know, it was kind of scoffed at, and even I thought, well, that might be a bit of an exaggeration. But then, when you actually started going into the numbers, the redeployment from Europe, you know, the continued deployments from the United States. The fact that in the late winter and spring of 1945, draft calls were going to be doubled. It's all quite public, which is interesting in light of the mess at the Air and Space Museum, you know, with the Enola Gay, where people would say that the veterans were crazy and had false memories when they would say that they were briefed to expect 500,000 casualties. But heck, you can go right to the front page of the New York Times and find where you have joint letters from Admiral King and General Marshall, and they're saying, we, and this is like in what, I guess it was it April or March? Yeah, you can look in the book. I can look it up. But, yeah, there's being real specific. They need to draft 900,000 replacements by the end of June. And draft calls by March were like, you know, pumped up to 100,000 men a month for a one-front replacement stream. Now that the calls were for 100,000 men for the Army. If you add the calls for the Navy and the Marine, that pumped it up by another 40,000. Yet when if you mention to someone today that in March of 1945, draft calls were being raised to 140,000 men per month. You know, it's like you're from Mars, but the numbers were quite astronomical, and was really based on the fact that they were looking at just for the initial invasion, the one on the southern island of Kyushu, that they were looking at something like about 100,000 all causes casualties a month. And that was, again, these figures, when you like recite them today, you know, astound people. You know, it's hard for people to get their hands around things like that, their mind around things like that. But it's not that much different from that, from the casualty surge that we had in 1945, which was principally from the European fighting. You know, it's just that it was going to extend. It was not going to end. At the time, people looked at this as us being in the middle of the war, not at the end of the war.
Well, this is Eagle One, and let me kind of set the stage here. There was a display at the Air and Space Museum in Washington of the Enola Gay, and it took the position, the politically correct position, that maybe that wasn't such a good mission, dropping the atomic bombs. And what you've done is counter that with this book by pointing out that there was the plans that were in place concluded that we would lose 500,000 to a million troops if we had to invade Japan. Is that correct?
Well, it depended on which plans, because there was different estimates made for different command levels over time, but yeah, as early as 1940, the midpoint of 1944, we were looking at, we had estimates running that, you know, we could have, 500,000 dead and considerably more than that, wounded or injured. And it was really based force on force. Now, later on, when it became apparent that there were far more Japanese forces that would have to be faced on the home islands than had originally been anticipated, because they were ramping up their own force structure at the time. In July 1945, that half a million got pushed up considerably. In July 1945, the War Department rather grimly predicted that, and this is a quote, "We shall probably have to kill 5 to 10 million Japanese, and this might cost us 1.7, or rather between 1.7 and 4 million casualties, including 400,000 to 800,000 killed." Now, at the same time, the Japanese, they were doing their own number crunching, and the number that was coming up and being used in imperial circles at that time was, this varied between documents after the war, and you wonder what, if there was like the ambiguities of translations, but the figure being used in imperial circles was 20 million. In some documents, it's translated as casualties. In others, it's translated as deaths. And apparently they were using casualties from Okinawa as their model on that. Which, interestingly enough, at the same time, you had Truman saying that he was looking. He said twice in a June 18th, meeting with Marshall, King, and others, what we were looking at was an Okinawa from one end of Japan to the other. So the interesting thing was is both sides were looking at a victory for the U.S., or at least in terms of the United States and its own estimates, we were looking at a victory in Japan, but it was going to be basically paved with a large number of dead, most of them Japanese.
Yeah, there have been a lot of people who will either poo-poo those figures or just won't even intellectually engage them. And a lot of people are familiar with the grainy black and white pictures that would show the suicide boats and the fleet of airplanes the kamikazes were going to use. But it was a lot more than that. It wasn't just going to be force on force. And another data point we had last month, the author Laura Hildebrand on to talk about her book Unbroken about Louis Zamperini, who was a POW for years in Japan. And he talked about the end of the war as they were going back and forth from the coal mines, that they would see the Japanese villagers, their women training with their spiked bamboo sticks, and the men doing their own military training. This wasn't just going to be the new American draftees versus what was left of the Imperial Army. This was going to be village by village, wife by wife, woman and child by woman and child campaign going up from the south up to the north. Something that for the veterans that were, because a lot of the forces you're using were going to be coming from Europe, that we occupying Germany was going to be a completely different experience than trying to conquer and occupy Japan.
And this indeed was something that both Marshall and Stimson stressed in meetings with President Truman. And again, the interesting thing about this is that while these casualty numbers are again poo-pooed as you say, and again they won't engage them. This was not thought to be terrible. This was not thought to be an outrageous set of estimates at the time. The United States had a relatively low number of casualties, by percent through the first years of its involvement in the war. But as we were moving towards the summer of 1944, for example, it was realized in the War Department that there was that the summer of 44 was going to bring what was called then and in and at the Staff College later on it was referred to as the casualty surge. And then starting in June of 1944, where you're starting with the invasion of the Marianas Islands and also the invasion of Europe, that last year of the war, just in combat casualties, mind you, we're not talking non-battle casualties, which were also very extensive and tended to move in tandem with the battle casualties, but just in battle casualties alone, in that last year of the U.S. Fighting in World War II, we were having an average of 60,000 casualties a month. That was the average. It peaked in November, December, and January, 44 to 45, where you had, I think it was 72,000, 88,000, and 79,000 casualties on those 3 months. And again, you hear these numbers now, and they sound absolutely mind-boggling, but this was the environment in which, you know, the wartime leaders at that time were living and were having to deal with and work with month by month. And we were indeed running out of manpower at that time, but we were again viewed as being in the midpoint of the war.
And that was in a population that was half of what this nation's population is
right now.
Eagle One.
Yeah, I was fascinated by the fact that your book covers a lot of the political pressure that was being brought on our leaders at the time to which they succumbed to a certain extent to retire, if you will, or to demobilize some of the most experienced troops who theoretically had more combat skills than the new guys who were going out to replace them. And I really appreciate the amount of new information you seem to have uncovered in your research that related to all
this
stuff.
Well, it's all been there. It's all been there. mostly it was a matter that a lot of this data was spread about somewhat, and this was a nice place to like bring it all together where, you know, people could have it in one relatively short package. I was able to keep the actual narrative to 90,000 words, and that was the idea, was to like pack it, and that's what I did.
Well, I was kind of interested too in the topic that you didn't discuss, because it really didn't have much to do with what happened to the Navy plan. As I understand it, the Navy plan you wrote was to blockade and starve the Japanese islands.
Basically,
why wasn't that route taken?
Well, basically, I actually get into that in, I think it was the third to the last, and also I think the last chapter. The basic problem that it had was that they could not come up with a timeline, any kind of a firm timeline for when a program of starvation in the home islands would actually work. It was understood that eventually it would work, but in the meantime, you have troops sitting. And we're not talking like, you know, 50,000 men, 100,000 men. You're talking about a force structure in the millions that is literally sitting at the end of a tenuous, surprisingly tenuous supply line that is unemployed for how long? The Japanese were clearly willing to sacrifice extremely large numbers of their own population, and the thinking at the senior levels of command in the United States was that this would also give the Japanese more time to follow various propaganda angles to wear down American war resolve. You know, the basic thing was is you could not have 2.5 men sit idle overseas while Japanese propaganda is being allowed to work on the American people. And also there's the staggering expense of a war that is just allowed to continue. You know, the idea was, is as Marshall stated several times, and it's and his quotes are in the book, is you've got to get it over with, and get it over with as early, you know, as possible. And that was basically it. You know, the Navy's plan was a workable plan, but the thing is no one knew how long it would take to work. And the documents that were being utilized at Yalta in particular, I think, actually ended up stating that explicitly.
I think it also there was also the Anglo-American political environment that at the end of World War II, a lot of people forget, Churchill was voted out of office. And a lot of that had to do with the British, that they were ready, Germans over, we need to transition, we need to go forward. You brought up the topic about the Japanese willing to sacrifice. And I think the argument can almost be made that the decision to go with the nuclear weapon was a very humanitarian decision in two areas. The first is we saw starting in once the B-29s could reach mainland Japan, that we quickly had worked up to the point, especially in 45, that it almost had become a city-by-city war of extermination. We saw that even before the nuclear weapons. And I don't think it would have taken very long with the initial casualties that took place in an invasion for it to just be that on land too, you know, napalm the entire town so we don't lose that many people next time, and just working up the home islands, exterminating the entire nation on the way. That would, I think, have really seared and changed the American view of their military, view of the war. But I think more importantly in the long term, you know, nowadays the U.S. and Japan get along very, very well. I don't think that would have been true if we had done a conventional, what would have evolved into a war of extermination until they finally surrendered, and we might have had the relationship on par with what the Japanese and the Chinese have today.
Well, that's where you get some of those War Department figures where, say, that July 45 estimate where we might end up, you know, having to kill at least 5 to 10 million Japanese, and the Japanese figures were actually double our estimate. But the Japanese militarists had been working, you know, of course, their society had a bent in that direction in the beginning, you know, to begin with, but the Japanese militarists, especially from the period where we invaded the Philippines, and then all the way through to when the emperor announced, you know, the surrender, that 1945 time frame in particular really doubled down on Bushido. Essentially, the militarists were working, well, the entire Japanese government at all levels was working to kind of erase that distinction between soldier and civilian that we pretty much take for granted in this country. I mean, this is beyond anything like, say, a militia or a National Guard. This is where the entire population is essentially becomes a, quote, shield of the emperor. And that's where you get these massive casualty figures actually being generated by both governments. And this was going to be, you know, U.S. soldiers had been pretty, well, actually, it's not an exaggeration to say diligent, had been pretty diligent about, you know, not killing civilians, even by accident. Now, you would have situations on Okinawa where there was a lot of artillery and naval bombardment that was going into areas that were not observed, you know, by artillery spotters. But, and you had situations where people ended up being sealed up in caves, but we had, as you read in the book, a really large infrastructure that was built up by the time of Okinawa just to preserve civilian, you know, lives. And with the translators out front, divisions, individual divisions carrying extremely large amount of like food for the civilians. We were actually pleased at how many people, civilians, were not killed at Okinawa. But the thing is it still was, you know, a horrifying you know, percentage in the number of civilians that were killed there. And these were Okinawans who were, had always been kind of second class citizens in the empire. You know, what was it going to be like when we moved into Japan, where virtually the entire population, you know, was really fairly receptive to the virulent propaganda? You know, you were going to have a situation where instead of just imperial troops, you were going to start seeing civilians and people in civilian garb attacking, you know, formations. And a lot of that reticence to inflict civilian casualties by, you know, Marines and Army, you know, ground pounders was going to melt as soon as you started seeing significant casualties being inflicted on your units and, you know, your squad by people in civilian clothes. Well, I tell you, the Japanese militarists had worked diligently to erase that line between civilian and military, and they had done a pretty good job and the end result was going to be a fantastic number of Japanese corpses.
Well, I was also fascinated by the. You took the time to set out the logistics issue of getting troops from Europe to go to Japan, part of which impacted our efforts in Europe. This is kind of off the central topic of this, but one of the reasons that we didn't go right into Berlin was we didn't have enough troops to both feed the Pacific and go into Berlin and fight the Germans. Is that a fair summation?
That it's a little simple, but yes, ultimately that was a big part of it. We were turning around and going the other way, and in fact, before he had an untimely death, Larry Bland, the editor of the George C. Marshall papers, he and I were going to be doing a somewhat expanded. There's a chapter on this in Hell to Pay, but we were going to be doing a somewhat expanded work together on this. And that's pretty much remained off the radar screens of historians just because, to make it brutally simple here, the inability to maintain a large-scale street fight involving one to two armies at the exact same time that we had to basically do an about-face and start sending 16 and then four more divisions later on, ultimately 20 divisions to the Far East, and at the same time do the widely announced mid-war demobilization, partial demobilization. It couldn't be done. They're just the troops did not exist, and there was no way to take Berlin on the cheap. It was just not something that anyone would suggest. And so what you basically see in a lot of the documents is, you know, cryptic comments to the unfavorable disposition of forces. Because see, all of our support for, say, 1st and 9th Armies was actually way to the west. So you'll see cryptic comments about that and projected casualties. But there was no serious discussion because it was not thought to be something that even deserved a serious discussion. I mean, there was just no way you could do it.
Yeah, I think also if we had to go ahead and execute Operation Downfall, imagine the impact that would have had on our ability to do reconstruction in Western Europe, the Marshall Plan, and all the ability that that gave us to keep the communists out. It would have been huge. And
you mentioned an interesting point because, right now we have, the anniversary of the surrender coming up, this coming week. But in fact, what you have, minus the atomic bombs and also the militarist, unwillingness to surrender in the face of like massive civilian casualties, was that, your VJ Day would less likely be a September 2nd, 1945, than sometime around, really about a year later. By the time you've got Tokyo invested and taken, the planners were looking at, if everything went well, Tokyo would be in U.S. hands by the end of the summer of 1946. Now, the question then comes in, that's Tokyo and the southern one-third of Kyushu. There's a lot of Japan out there. And we're occupying some pretty small hunks of it, and so there was a whole series of subsidiary area operations that were projected going on into 1947. So again, it gets back to that whole thing: is that when we're looking at that mid-war demobilization, it really was indeed mid-war from the standpoint of the war leaders at that time. They were looking at operations going into 1947.
Parallel Universe, Alternative Histories. And Dennis, thanks a lot this Sunday for coming on. That was a real fast 30 minutes. I really appreciate the time. And again, for all the listeners, the book is Hell to Pay, Operation Downfall and the Invasion of Japan, 1945 to 1947. What's next on your plate there, Dennis?
Oh, well, I just finished up a history of the U.S. Army for Barnes & Noble. That'll be out in October. That was a lot of fun. A lot of support from the museum at West Point on that and various other organizations. And by the way, not alternative history. These were the plans. So that's a very different thing than alternative history. This is what we were actually looking at implementing.
Absolutely.
Army. I've heard of that before.
yeah, right.
It's not football season yet. It's not football season. But thanks again, Dennis, and I hope you have a great week.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dennis.
Bye-bye.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us live, and we hope to see you again soon for our next episode of MidRats. Have a great Navy Day.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly.